The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
You'll have to excuse my voice this evening. It's kind of nasally.
I think most people have had that or are in the middle of having it. And if you haven't, you're going to get it.
Exactly. Well, I'm on the mend anyway. I want to wish all of our listeners happy holidays.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you observe Easter or Passover, don't eat too much chocolate and don't eat too much matzah. And for sure, don't eat chocolate-covered matzah.
Unless, of course, you had to have one of those for April Fool's Day.
We're going to talk about April Fool's Day because there was a lot of funny stuff on April Fool's this
yes,
week.
Yes, there was.
Yeah. A lot of funny bicycle stuff. So, meanwhile, we have a slightly different show this week. No frame builders.
Okay.
No riders. No books to review.
What's left?
I knew you were going to say that. We have very interesting topics, two of them, and we have experts in each. With all the controversy in Indiana, I assume everybody's been following that. I have to say up front that my first guests were already in the queue for this evening before all hell broke loose out there. Okay?
Right.
Okay. So Jordan Bailey is the race director for the Indiana University Little 500 bike race, which will be running April 24th and 25th of this year. Always the third week of April. The first IU Little 500 was held in 1951.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago.
In front of 7,000 spectators. And from that event, they raised around $6,000 for student scholarships. That is the purpose of the race. Today, the Little 500 is the largest collegiate bike race in the U.S. There will be more than 25,000 fans there to support the riders. And the foundation, which still has the same goals, has raised more than $1 million in student scholarship money.
That's
Isn't
amazing.
That cool? So many of us learned about this race for the first time by watching Breaking Away.
Yep.
Today, the frats and cutters still duke it out for the prestige of the win. It's really sort of about pride. But there's also a new documentary. So this is a new movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched the trailer for it. It's called One Day in April. Tom Miller, who is the director of the movie, is also with us. It follows four teams as they train and race in the 2013 Little 500. It was sent up as an Indiegogo. It got funded. And you can watch a two-minute trailer on YouTube, or if you want to see the whole first screening of the movie, if you head on out to Bloomington, Indiana on April 24th, they're going to have it that evening.
That's great.
That is cool. So then we're going to take a break, and we'll do some news, and then we're going to go down to Richmond, Virginia, and we're going to speak with Tim Miller. So, yeah, there's a Tim Miller and a Tom Miller. I was having a little problem with that, but as far as I know, they're not at all related. So Tim is the COO, the commanding officer, so to speak, of the UCI-sanctioned World Road Race Championship events that are going to be held in Richmond, Virginia in September. With the courses already in place, the event schedule's ready to go, and some extra events in which you can participate, Richmond is just about ready to host this world-class event. I think it's going to be so exciting, so exciting. So I wanted to know how they're getting ready to host 450,000 people for the 9 days it's going to take to run all the events, and how Richmond became the venue. Yeah, I think that'll be interesting. So first, we're going to go off to Bloomington, Indiana to talk with Jordan Bailey and Tom Miller. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks, Diane. Be here.
Well, we're here to talk about the Indiana University Little 500, which takes place the third weekend in April, as well as the new documentary about the race. So most of us remember the IU event from Breaking Away. In fact, I think the event pretty much was put on the map by Breaking Away. Jordan, let's start with you. Give us a bit of history about the Indiana University Little 500 race, when it began, what the foundation represents, and how the race works.
Absolutely. So you're exactly right. The Breaking Away film that came out in 79 and won the Oscar for Best Screenplay really did put Little 500 on the map. But it started much before that, back in 1951, when a man by the name of Howdy Wilcox, who was the former president of the Indiana University Foundation, had gotten the idea of creating a bicycle race modeled after the Indianapolis 500. His dad was an Indy 500 winner in the 1920s, and so he wanted a way to involve students on campus to connect them to Indiana University while they were here, so that when they became alumni, they would remain connected and remain loyal, and eventually go on to become donors when they got older. So the first race was held in 1951 and modeled after the Indianapolis 500. Many of the rules and procedures and so forth are very similar to the race up at the Speedway, with a couple of differences. First, it's not 500 miles, but rather 50. So instead of a 2.5 mile paved track, they are racing on a quarter mile cinder track for 200 laps. There are 33 teams, all of which have to qualify for the event. And instead of just one driver and one car, it's actually four people make up a bike team. So they can trade off whenever they want, whenever they get tired. And the first team to 200 laps is the winner of the race. So Howdy created it back in 1951. And since then, the mission and the goal of the race has remained the same: to provide scholarship dollars to students on the Bloomington campus. So all of the gate receipts from those races back in 51 all the way up until this year in 2015 just go right back to benefiting the students on the Bloomington campus.
How are these teams chosen? I know you've got people who are not fraternities, people who are, as the movie originally talked about, the Cutters. I mean, they were the heroes, of course, of Breaking Away. And you also have a women's race now. So you don't just have a men's, don't you have a women's race that's shorter? Maybe it's the day before, as I remember.
So we held the women's race. We'll celebrate the 28th running in a couple weeks here. And they have their race on Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Their race, instead of being 100 laps, is only 100 laps. So it's a much shorter, and actually it provides, because it's a shorter race, the strategy that goes into it is a little bit more interesting. And honestly, it has grown and developed to be just as, if not more so, competitive than the men's race. And we get the same number of fans that come out on Friday afternoon as we do on Saturday, which is really terrific to see. But to go back to your original question, all of the students that participate in the Little 500 are, in fact, IU undergraduate students. So Breaking Away is a little bit of a misnomer in that the storyline there was that the Cutters were a group of just counties that race in the college bike race. We do in fact have all IU undergrads that participate, and many of them are fraternities and sororities, but we do have a lot of residence halls that participate, in addition to just teams that form from independent groups that aren't associated with the Greek system.
I want to get back to the bikes, but I know Tom's time is short. So Tom, hi, how are you?
I'm doing great.
I want to talk about the documentary One Day in April. It's going to be screened on the 14th, is that correct, of this month?
It's going to be screened on April 24th, right after the women's race.
Okay. So tell us about the film, and you're the director. You followed four teams, as I understand it?
Yes, we did.
Okay. So explain the premise of the film, what it was that had you put this film together.
Yeah, so I was an IU student, and I graduated from IU with a degree in journalism, and basically every year I was there, I would go and cover the race as a photographer, and, you know, there was really nothing else like it. And, you know, there was just, there's so much like pageantry to it, but also, you know, there's these teams, these kids have so much going on that drives them to do it, because the race is really unique in that there's nothing on the line other than pride. There's no, you know, there's no money. Nobody's going pro. You know, and so these kids train like NCAA athletes for a sport that is essentially just intramural. So, you know, it was always really, really fascinating to me. And after college, I went and worked as a cinematographer for President Obama on his campaign and then at the inauguration. And when I wrapped that up, my wife was still finishing up school, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my time. And I was talking to a buddy, who Peter Stevenson, who, you know, helped do the film with me. And we were just like, you know, there is a real story in Little 500. You know, a lot of folks know Breaking Away, but there's a story about this race that hasn't been told. You know, the real story, kind of like looking at who these people are, what motivates them, you know, why do they do it. And so we kind of just like on a lark said, okay, let's give it a shot. You know, we had some cameras. We didn't have anything really fancy. And we just started shooting. And we picked four teams completely, just thinking like, well, I don't know if we're going to have enough stuff for a movie, so we'll need to have, you know, plenty of teams. And we picked the two teams, the Cutters and Teeter, who had won the most times the most recently. Cutters had just had an end to their five-year run, and Teeter had just had an end to a three-year run. And then we picked the returning champions, so Delta Gamma and Delta Tau Delta. And so what really happened is we just started, and we just really dug into these people's stories and just dug into the different characters across these four teams and, you know, and beyond, of why people do this and why it's so special. And so ultimately the film kind of turned out to be a look at, you know, it is a look at the race. It is a look at what makes it special, but it's also about how people, you know, create meaning for themselves, you know, through sports, through teamwork, you know, in the race, because it is this really amateur thing, it's just totally unique in that sense that everybody there is motivated by a desire to be there. Like, nobody rides in the Little 500 for any reason other than they want to be a part of it and, you know, they want to compete. And so, you know, the film just became this really, like, you know, I call it Friday Night Lights on bikes. You know, we were essentially just looking, making a film about how in Southern Indiana people have made this event where we kind of come together for no reason other than to celebrate, you know, the teamwork and the commitment these people put into being riders and, you know, to give folks a chance. I steal this from JB, but he said, you know, to be heroic, you know, and to be a champion. So I mean, that's really what the film is about.
I'm speaking with Jordan Bailey and Thomas Miller. We're talking about the Little 500 in Indiana, which is going to take place on the 24th of this month and 25th. And we're talking about the film One Day in April. So how long is the film, Tom?
Yeah, so it's feature length. It's about 100 minutes. Yeah, so
wow.
It's a full. I mean, we said we didn't know if we had enough content from 14, so we ended up with like hundreds of hours. The first cut of the film was 6 hours long, and nobody but me and JB would watch it. So, you know, it's about 100 minutes now.
I don't know. There are a bunch of cyclists in Cleveland who would probably sit there with popcorn and watch it. So that is my next question. It's being screened there. Will it be available for people around the country?
Yeah, so we were very fortunate. We had a world premiere at Cinequest Film Festival out in San Jose in February. And, you know, right now we're working on a couple things. We're going to hopefully do more screenings, but, you know, the goal and where we're headed right now is towards getting it available for folks to purchase online through, you know, the usual outlets, iTunes, Amazon, that kind of thing. So hopefully in the next couple months, we'll, you know, you just keep an eye out on onedayinapril.com. We'll have some good news for folks who can't get to a screening.
Yeah, well, I'm suggesting, and I think we said in our opening that if you want to go to Indiana and watch it on the 24th. Jordan, I want to get back to you for a second. This week, the Indiana Speedway put up a big sign that said, everyone welcome here. Everybody knows what's going on in Indiana. I wonder if you think that all this political nonsense is going to affect the race and people coming to see it, or does the campus, I mean, you have to have an LGBT community on campus. What's going on?
Absolutely. I would say that it's interesting. Bloomington is a little bit of a pocket in Indiana.
And President McRobbie, the president of the university, came out earlier in the week, actually on, over the weekend last Sunday, and came out against Governor Pence in the bill that came out in the House. And I think that with the clarification that he's signing into law, I think we'll get through it. Even before all of that stuff came out, the Little 500 and the Student Foundation has actually partnered with the Commission on Multicultural Understanding, which is a student group here on campus. And so we're partnering for this year's race for the first time. Their goal is to gather as much information and encourage programs and activities that will increase awareness and understanding of factors which lead to racism and other forms of oppression. So that's their mission, to educate people about that. So their big fall campaign is a campaign called I Won't Stand For. So they go out and they make T-shirts that say, I won't stand for, and then, you know, fill in the blank. I won't stand for racism. I won't stand for bigotry, et cetera. So we're kind of tilting that on its head and doing a partnership with them where we're going to do Little 500 Stands For, and then fill in the blank with everyone. So I think that people are really going to be able to embrace that and have a reason to celebrate. And again, going back to Tom's point of just Little 500 being an event that everybody can buy into, and really, it is a true representation and a cross section of the university for all these different organizations to have a stake and have a team to cheer for, and a representation of those organizations.
Yeah, and actually, if I could just tag on to that real quick, one of the key things about the film and why I think this film turned out so great is that the Little 500, if you look at its history, it has been a place where people, like, define their identity with. You know, the story of the women's race is incredible. I mean, there's a team, the Theta team, goes to qualify for the men's race, you know, and show that the girls can do it just like the guys can, and then a year later, you know, there's the first women's race. And, you know, when you watch the film, the thing that makes the race so great and the Little 500 so special is that, you know, regardless of anything else going on in your life, like, you can get a team together of three like-minded people, you can go out and compete, and you can win. You know, and I think that that's really, really special. And I think that the Little 500, and especially, like, from the perspective of the film, you know, that's what Indiana is about. You know, that's Hoosier values. You know, the Little 500 is Hoosier values, and those values of inclusion, for sure.
Well, I do know that there are several huge bicycle organizations in Indiana. They put on the Rain Ride and the Treary Ride and all kinds of stuff that I know a lot of my friends and customers go and participate in. So I don't see Indiana as being so sort of, I hate to use the word bigoted, I just don't see that, you know. Can we talk about the bikes themselves for a minute? Because that's kind of my area of expertise. They are single speed bikes, right?
Correct.
Who supplies the bikes these days?
So Schwinn is our bicycle manufacturer. They actually did the first 5 years of bike, and then if you remember back to Breaking Away days, we switched for a number of years, probably 40 plus, to Roadmaster. So the famous lines were, gentlemen, mount your Roadmaster bicycles. And then about 10 years ago, we made the switch back to Schwinn, who has been doing it ever since. And just to nerd out a little bit on the specs, so they are single speed bikes, 46:18 gear ratio. So a really, you know, pedal it fast in order to go fast. And then unlike a track bike, it does have a coaster brake in the rear hub. So imagine the type of bike that you rode when you were a little kid and you pedal backwards, that engages the rear wheel to lock up. And the cinder surface that we ride on is a little bit, it's kind of, the best way I can describe it is it's kind of like gravel, a very fine gravelly dirt. So as they lock up that rear wheel, they get this skidding action along the top of the surface, and that's how they end up exchanging from one person to the other. So the bike really slows down only just a touch, but it never comes to a complete stop as one person grabs it and then the other person jumps off and the outgoing rider jumps back on.
It's really a fascinating race. So what do you think the top speeds are?
You know, our average speeds for the course of the race, so over 2 hours, they're easily averaging a 25-mile-an-hour speed. And, of course, we have caution laps and yellow flags, so that'll bring down the average sometimes. And then on the very opening lap and on the last lap is obviously when they get to be their fastest. And those guys on some of those laps can be upwards of 30 miles an hour on that 46-18 gear ratio.
Well, my last question has to do with the funds that are raised, the scholarship funds. How exactly are the funds? I mean, obviously, there's no prize money. There's the, trophy or whatever they get for winning the race. But where are the funds coming from to support the scholarship?
So all of the tickets sold for race day, of people coming inside and watching the race, all those tickets sold then go back to fund scholarships for students on the Bloomington campus. A lot of them are for rider scholarships, but then I would say that the majority are for students that are working their way through school. So they're the folks that are holding down a job and also putting themselves through school because of that job. And as I mentioned at the opening, that really has been consistent and the same since 1951, which is pretty special.
Yeah, it is. Tom, before you jump off, tell our listeners how they can watch the trailer and then follow what's going on so that eventually they can see the movie.
Yeah, so we have a couple trailers on YouTube right now. So if you search One Day in April trailer on YouTube, you'll find it. And the best place where we're the most active is our Facebook, which is facebook.com/One Day in April. We've got the trailer. We just put up a highlight reel from those last quals, and we put the soundtrack to the film is on there streaming now. So lots of good stuff. And then on our website as well, onedayinapril.com.
And then, Jordan, tell listeners how they can – is there ever going to be any televised or any television or any kind of video of the Little 500?
Absolutely. We have actually been in a terrific partnership now for almost 13 years with Access TV, which is the network owned by IU alumnus Mark Cuban, also owner of the Mavericks and star on ABC's Shark Tank. He owns a network called Access AXS TV, which you can check your local listings for. But they specialize in a lot. They do a lot of actually concerts that they'll televise. But we've been fortunate enough to have them broadcast both the men and women's races since 2003. And so you can check that out at home, or if you want to make the trip to Bloomington here in a couple of weeks, tickets can be found on Ticketmaster.com or through our website, iusf.indiana.edu.
That is awesome. Jordan Bailey, Thomas Miller, the Little Indiana 500 race coming up, and the movie One Day in April. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I hope you have a great weekend. Happy holidays to you. And we'll talk maybe after the event and see who won this year.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Tom Miller, Jordan Bailey, join me from Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. What an interesting conversation. It's really good to hear that it is an all-come race. Everybody is welcome. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to do some news, and then we will go down to Richmond, Virginia to talk about the World Championship races coming up in September.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And I have to start with my favorite ridiculous story for the week. This is not even an April Fool's.
Just a ridiculous story.
It's just a ridiculous story.
Okay.
It's from ABC6onyourside.com in California, where a homeowners association is, ready for this, fining families whose children are playing on the sidewalks.
That's just crazy.
This ranks right up there with the homeowners association, I think it was in Massachusetts, that insisted you could not hang your laundry out to dry a few years ago. That was another one of those ridiculous things. Only this time, we're talking about the safety of kids. So, San Diego, Kate Murphy. Neighbors in a San Diego community are reportedly furious with their homeowners association's new policy of issuing fines for children caught playing in driveways and on sidewalks. Now, the photograph that they showed, and I think there was a short video, were kids playing on like Hot Wheels and bicycles, especially. The homeowners association that oversees this neighborhood says no wheeled toys can be used in common areas, including bikes, scooters, rollerblades, and skateboards.
They're supposed to use hovercraft or what?
Drones. Families with children caught playing on sidewalks will receive a $50 fine. If the original fine is not paid within 1 month, an additional $50 will be tacked on. It's ridiculous, says neighbor Danielle Carr. Our children should have a right to play in our paved areas as long as they are safe. Parents supervising them, that shouldn't be an issue. Carr says the most frustrating aspect is the fact that this rule is only in effect in a few neighborhoods. Her children reportedly have friends down the street who are allowed to play on the sidewalk. The property manager said the rules are needed for safety purposes. And here's my answer to that. Hire a new property manager. Let's get them out of there. That is ridiculous.
Vote a new board.
Vote in a new board. You got it.
Quick update. RAGBRAI?
Yes.
As of the beginning of this month, the deadline has come and gone for registration for the week-long. You can still register for a single-day event.
Right.
But if you missed that, schedule that again for next year.
Right.
We did get some good news out of Denver this week. The USA Pro Challenge cycling race is adding three stages for women this summer. Race organizers announced the change on Tuesday in Breckenridge, where the USA Women's Pro Challenge will begin August 21st with an individual time trial. The Denver Post reports Fort Collins and Golden will host stages the following 2 days. The women will receive the same prize money as men. The amount won't be known until the cycling's governing body set those figures closer to the event. The men's race will begin August 17th. And conclude on the 23rd. So they have a 6-day event. The women have a 3-day event. But the great thing is I found this article in USA Today. So
it wasn't even just like a cycling.
It wasn't the usual cycling location. So it's great to see that we have a women's event, but it's even better to see that it's in USA Today.
Well, speaking of women, did you watch 60 Minutes this past Sunday?
I did not.
Okay. So they had a segment on how a researcher has been working for 25 years on taking the polio virus and altering the structure of it and then using it to invade tumors. And they are having an amazing success with glioblastomas. Ergo, our friend Jackie Crowell has, you know, the possibility that this might be a protocol for her in the not-too-distant future if she needs it. I think she's doing just fine right now, but she posted it on Facebook, so she's all excited about it. I think it's awesome.
That is exciting news for a lot of people.
It's very exciting.
And it's always great to hear those, the progress that we make with all of those.
Well, there's a little more progress, too, and this was my video of the week. It's long. It's a conversation on Parkinson's disease. On March 23rd, the White House hosted a Champions of Change event honoring people in the Parkinson's community who are doing an extraordinary job to advocate for better treatments and cure. And first up was our friend and past cycling champion, Davis Finney, looking as handsome as ever. He began by thanking his wife, Connie Carpenter. But it was a very interesting video, and it is all about the work that he's, you know, his organization is doing, and his organization is doing a lot of stuff. So that was kind of cool to see Davis Finney in the White House.
Quick shout out to Liberty University down in Lynchburg, Virginia. They're starting this fall. The addition of a men's and women's cycling team will bring the total number of sports offered through their club sports to 35. So it's great to see another club program getting started for men and women.
In cycling at the collegiate level.
Yes.
Yes. Very, very good.
Did you happen to see the video of the Volvo Night Reflective Spray Paint?
Yes. You know what? If that was not an April Fool's joke, because did you look at the bike? The saddle's pointed down. They painted the rims and tires. I mean, seriously?
You're going to even enjoy this even more if you read the article more, and I pulled this off of Wired.com. The paint isn't designed for bikes.
Oh, okay, fine.
The paint is designed for your clothing.
Oh.
So it's designed that you can spray your clothes, and it's an invisible paint that you don't see anything during the day, but it reflects at night. Now, this is it made by Volvo, or a company that worked with Volvo, Life Paint, which is over in London. Now, there is another company that does a similar product here in the United States.
Why did they paint the bike then? Why didn't they paint the clothes?
That was the question they asked in the article. Why did you mislead everybody to thinking it was the bike? Now, here's the other thing is, if you don't like it on your jacket or whatever it is that you're wearing, throw it in the wash. And you can, with a detergent, take the paint off, which is a really cool thing.
That
which
is a cool thing.
That makes a lot more sense than had they gone with
it's
the
washable.
Other just on the bike.
Yeah.
Right, it's washable.
Cool.
So,
best April Fool's cycling joke was Specialized S-Works S4 selfie stem. And if it wasn't a joke, it should have been a joke. So it's this giant arm that comes up from your stem, and it shows your phone right in front of you, and it takes selfies while you're riding. So why not just crash into something, right?
I'm sure if you go look at Kickstarter or any of those, I'm sure there are a couple of those already out there.
You think?
Yes.
All right.
This is probably one of my favorite April Fool's jokes.
Okay.
And if you're interested in some other cycling-based ones, if you go to bikeradar.com, they listed a whole bunch of them there. This one is almost believable also, and this is the idea of Fabian Cancellara's fragrance that he put out. According to the Trek press office, Monument by Spartacus is the bold new fragrance that brings the essence of the world champion for first time to bedrooms, nightclubs, and locker rooms around the world.
Bedrooms? Nightclubs
well,
and
locker
rooms.
Well, if you're wearing it, that's where it's supposed to be.
I see.
Apparently, years in development, the fragrance embodies passion, courage, the roar of the Lion of Flanders with deep, full-bodied bass notes of Spartacus, blah, 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 blah. And it goes on. They actually even made a video. So they really took it to the extreme, which made it even that much more sellable. So if anybody wants to sell you Spartacus cologne, pass.
I don't really have any more April Fool's jokes, but this should have been one. This is from Cyclocross Magazine. They posted an article about the UCI getting into the gravel series bike regulations. If it's true, there's going to be a lot of grumbling. The first thing they decided to discuss, the size of the gravel. Really? Seriously? So the gravel segment is the Wild West of bike racing. It really needs us right now, said USA Cycling CEO Steve Johnson. It needs them. It's like pleading for them. Promoters and bike companies throw around the term gravel loosely. Never mind. That's a whole nother thing. Racers don't know what to expect when they see such a term, and there's no formal regulation on equipment, categories, call-ups, or upgrades. Oh, well, this was a grassroots, gravel roots idea. I'm not sure that I really like this idea because here's the first thing, defining gravel, right?
Right.
While dictionary.com defines gravel as, quote, small stones and pebbles or a mixture of these with sand, USA Cycling plans to get much more specific with the goal of making events safer to help grow the sport. The governing body will define gravel as, one, no single track is allowed. Two, stones and pebbles may not be larger than 1 centimeter in diameter. Three, no section of sand can be more than 4 centimeters deep. Four, dirt roads without visible gravel may only constitute a maximum of 10% of the course. And then they're going to regulate the bikes. And then they're going to regulate this. And then they're going to regulate that. Why can't we just go out and have a good time on our gravel bikes?
I think we should do that and let the UCI just let them deal with what they already have on the books now and just enforce what's there. And what material is that 1 centimeter piece of gravel made out of? Is that a certain stone that you can use? Can it be man-made? Can it be synthetic? And it can go to all kinds of different crazy places that we don't need to.
That is correct.
One more. So
okay.
I came across an interesting, and you said this week we're not talking about bike shows or bikes. Well, this is a bike show that I think we need to be at next year. This is the most glamorous bicycle show on earth. It's the Like Bike Show. It takes place in Monte Carlo. This is probably one that we should go to. And there were two, besides all the interesting thing that's there, and if you have any interest, likebikemc.com, all the information is there. And this actually takes place this weekend. It ends on Sunday. And if you're somewhere over there and you go there on Sunday, let us know how it was. But one of the neat things that they did is this was actually took place last week. They had a night ride, and it took place on the actual racetrack that is the Monaco Grand Prix, which is such a historic event for racing. It was really cool to see that they have that. One of the other articles that I found interesting is Pininfarina has a bicycle design that will be shown there. Pininfarina, they do Ferraris and they do all kinds of other stuff. This bike is really cool to see all of the things that are there. Now, this is a bike that cost 9,000 euros, which is about £9,700 or $9,700 for us. It's got leather stitch seats. It's just it's a really nice looking daily rider, basically. But here's the interesting thing that I found is it has a little sort of a booster in its back wheel designed by Zeus. It's an electric wheel that helps you ride that you don't have to charge, you don't have to plug in, you don't have to do anything. And if you want to control it, you control it with an app that you have in your smartphone. When you're braking, it charges itself, so it will collect from that. It also has a locking feature that if somebody steals it with this app, you can lock it so you can't ride it or do anything with
it. Wow, it's like locking down your iPad, huh?
Yeah, but if you're going to have a $9,000...
Yeah, why are you locking it up somewhere?
Where is it going to go anywhere?
So, wear it.
This is really interesting. So I want to make sure that we put this on the schedule for bike shows that we visit next year.
See if we can't get funded to go to Monte Carlo?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Fine.
It's only a three-day event. So
I see. Okay. Well, on that note, I guess we need to take a break, and we will be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist. Good afternoon, Tim. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
We are only 169 days away from the UCI World Road Race Championships in Richmond because I peeked at your website. They will take place September 19th through 27th. So can you give us a little bit of background on how Richmond was chosen for this event?
Yeah, it's it really starts with myself and a couple of other people that had this harebrained idea that, we would go after it. We had heard through the grapevine that the UCI, the International Governing Body for the Sport of Cycling, was interested in seeing a U.S. city bid on the event. It hadn't been in this country since 1986 when it was held in Colorado Springs. And they really wanted to see it come back to the U.S. And we had heard that. And so we started thinking about, maybe we had to take a crack at this. And the more we talked about it, we're like, Richmond wouldn't be a bad place for this. So that's really where it started.
What was the process like? What did you have to do to appeal to the UCI to say Richmond, Virginia is a really good place for the World Road Race Championships?
Well, I mean, the first thing we had to do was get the mayor of Richmond on board. And that took some time. but, we began working on him and his staff to convince him that this would be a good thing for Richmond and the Richmond region. Once we got to that point, obviously along the way we had to get USA Cycling's buy-in, which was a lot easier. Then we started, working with the UCI and kind of talking, letting them know that we were interested in pursuing this and that, we might actually go down that road. Once we finally got the mayor on board and we sort of started to convince the corporate community in the Richmond area to at least in theory get behind it, we actually announced in December of 2010 that we would officially be bidding on it, and it really all started from there. And then that's when we got the official documents that laid out, the bid process and the requirements and all that stuff.
So what is your background exactly?
So I have a background in both competitive cycling and on the organizer's side of the sport. My my first job out of college, I worked for the original Medalist Sports that owned and operated the old Tour de Trump and Tour de Pont bike races. Started up in Wilmington, Delaware, and finished, well, towards the latter part of the Tour de Pont. It stretched all the way down to the Atlanta area. Yeah, it was a 12-day stage race that, you know, went down the East Coast. And it just so happened that Medalist Sports was headquartered in Richmond, so, which, you know, I'm from Richmond, so, you know, I got a job with Medalist, and that's where I sort of cut my teeth on the business side of cycling, of sports marketing and event development.
One of the cool things about the road race championships is that you don't need a velodrome, A.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about tracks. So you've got road and time trial, team time trial. You've got juniors, men, and women, elite men and elite women. I see that the schedule's already up and the courses are already laid out. Can you give us some insight into how you determined those courses and how you were able to get those courses through the proper channels so that you're going to be able to, because, I mean, it's what, 9 days or something? It's a long event.
Yeah. Well, first, I will say, you know, you said at the beginning that, you know, you don't need a velodrome. In a lot of ways, it would be easier just to have a velodrome. and possibly cheaper.
Interesting. Oh, because of the police, sure.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, I know. I used to do a triathlon up here, and man, I'll tell you, that's where the expense was.
Yeah. But, the process, you know, it really started with, and this was one of the advantages of me having a competitive cycling background and sort of understanding the sporting side of cycling. And then, you know, having worked on the Tour de Pont, and then I also I created and ran for 4 years my own criterium here in Richmond. So, you know, I had some experience laying out courses, and, you know, it always sort of dabbled with road circuit courses in Richmond in my mind over the years, just hoping that one day they would come to fruition. So, but you know, it started with, you know, I sort of laid out an initial course, which actually a road circuit is remarkably similar to what I had originally come up with. But, you know, then we brought in some additional expertise. My first job out of college was working for the original Medalist Sports, because after the Tour de Pont ended in 1996, that version of Medalist Sports closed, but it reopened in 2004, and Medalist Sports exists today and is the company that runs, you know, sort of event operations for the Tour of California and the USA Pro Challenge and the US Pro Championships and the Tour of Alberta. Basically, all the major international races in this country are actually run and managed by the current Medalist Sports. And so we partnered with them and brought them in and all their technical expertise. And so they tweaked my road course a little bit and then helped us develop the team time trial course and the individual time trial course. We actually have four different courses for the World Championships. And so, you know, they helped with that. But to your point, I mean, obviously, you know, a big component of designing a race course is the impact of that course and the road closures on the community. So, you know, when we developed the courses, you know, we really kept three things in mind. One was the competition itself and what was best for the competition. The other thing was what would the traffic impact be on the community. And then the third piece was tourism. You know, what are the things that the community is going to want to showcase to this global television audience? And so, you know, we try to keep all those things in mind as we put these courses together. And by and large, I think we were fairly successful. But it's amazing the cooperation that you get, you know, when you're telling the community, well, you know, this has a television audience of hundreds of millions of people. All of a sudden, it's like, oh, wow, okay, yeah, this might be worth it. the other thing I will say is we have unbelievable support from the police. There's a the captain of the special operations for the Richmond Police Department has really become embedded with us, and is almost part of our staff, and has become just an invaluable resource. And the even better part of that story is that at the beginning of this process, he was not a cyclist. He's now a cyclist.
Of course he is. How could you not fall in love with cycling? I want to remind our listeners who are speaking with the chief operating officer of the World Road Cycling Championships. They are going to be in Richmond, Virginia. We are talking with Tim Miller. So I want to ask you about, because you alluded to it, the economic impact. And I know there is a huge economic impact. Cleveland was awarded the Republican National Convention. So we know all of the things that are going to be happening here and housing and all of that. But I'm seeing some amazing numbers, 450,000 people who are going to be watching this event in person.
Yeah. And we did do an economic impact study at the very beginning of this process. And that's the estimate that study produced. To be clear, it's 450,000 people. That's over the course of the entire 9 days, and it does include the local population that will come and witness the event. So that's not 450,000 out of towners that are going to show up in Richmond on September 19th and stay until the 27th.
Yeah, where would you put them all? Right.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
But it does include a substantial number of people that are going to come from, you know, outside of the region and outside of the country. But the projected economic impact for this event statewide throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia is estimated to be $158 million. And of that, $128 million is estimated to be the impact in the Richmond region.
Wow, you can't beat that. You know, for a 9-day event, that's pretty good. That sort of amortizes itself out over like a big deal. So I guess one of the other questions I want to ask is, did you make infrastructure, or are you making infrastructure changes or adding housing or doing anything that you might not have done had you not gotten this event?
We're not doing things that wouldn't otherwise be done. I mean, there's a lot of paving and sidewalk repair and signage repair and that kind of stuff being done, but you know, it's, and you know, we talk about this with the municipalities, is there are things that needed to be done anyway. Now, would they have necessarily paved Broad Street where the course is going to go before September of 2015? Not necessarily. So it's more of sort of a juggling of schedules and juggling of priorities. So it's not that they're spending more money on anything. It's just that they're reprioritizing what does get paved, what does get repaired, that kind of stuff. But no, there's nothing special that had to be built. I mean, that was one of the things that the mayor sort of recognized and got behind, is that, oh, this is great. You know, this is not like the Olympics where you got to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on facilities and all that kind of stuff. That's not the case here. All of the event specific facilities and infrastructure either existed already, like our convention center, or is temporary, like tents and that kind of stuff.
There is mention of a cobbled course. Are you building a cobbled course? I will talk about Crush the Cobbles in a second, but is there actually a racing course that the riders, the elite riders, will be riding that is cobbled?
There is, and we didn't have to build it. It already existed. There are several sections of cobblestones on our road race course. So we have a very historic avenue in Richmond called Monument Avenue that is, it's truly, it's not actually cobblestones. They're Belgian pavers. And relative to, you know, the cobblestones of Belgium or other places, they're relatively smooth. But there is that section. But then we do have two other sections that are true cobblestones. We've got about a 900-meter-long serpentine climb that goes up through a park that's part of the road circuit that is truly a narrow cobblestone road that if you saw it, you would think you might be in Flanders or somewhere in Belgium. And then we have another short but extremely steep, on the order of magnitude of 15% grade, that is a short, roughly 600-meter long climb that is also cobblestone.
Wow, that's awesome. That's just awesome. There are a couple of amateur events that you're going to sort of sandwich in to the races. One's called Crush the Cobbles, and I think there's something else going on. What are the other things that are going on that people can participate in who are amateurs?
Yeah, there are two events. They're actually called Conquer the Cobbles, although I kind of like to Crush the Cobbles a little better. But
you know what? I kind of copied it. I thought, okay, Conquer the Cobbles.
I don't know. Maybe people are calling it Crush the Cobbles out there in social media land. I don't know. But yeah, they're actually called Conquer the Cobbles. So there's two of them. On the Thursday night of the event, there is a running event around the road circuit. So we're going to it's Thursday the 24th of September, is what's known as a training day for the athletes. So we close down the road circuit, and they have a sort of a free 2 hours to ride the road circuit and just kind of get familiar with it. And there's no competition that day. So that night, we're doing this Conquer the Cobbles run, where we'll set down the course and have a running race for the community around the course, and for, you know, anybody that wants to enter. And then the following night, on Friday the 25th, we will have another edition of Conquer the Cobbles, but it's a cycling event. And so starting at 7 o'clock for 2 hours, it'll basically be a free, or I should say not free, open, public ride of the road circuit. So for 2 hours, people will be able to pay an entry fee and ride around the World Championship circuit for as much or as little as they want.
Are you going to be doing things like painting the road or putting up, you know, the big arches and those kinds of things? I mean, is it going to look like a European course, or are you doing something more, and I hate to use the air quotes, American?
It will look fairly European, I think. I mean, we will have the arches. I mean, the UCI will bring a number of arches that, you know, are provided by their sponsors. You know, there has been some discussion about sections of the course where we may allow chalk paint, or, you know, we may get some schools involved, that kind of thing. I would anticipate, and I've been to the last four World Championships, and so, you know, I can tell you that it's pretty remarkable the number of people that come with the flags of their nations, and it just creates this unbelievable scene of just this sea of national flags along the roadside. So it will, in my estimation, it will look fairly European.
I think it's awesome. I am just so excited. I plan on coming down.
You absolutely should, as should all your listeners.
Of course we should. So tell us how people can find out more about the Worlds. I assume anybody can show up and participate in either the events or just watch the races.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the beauties of professional cycling events, is that, you know, they're free and open to the public. You know, there are certainly some restricted areas around the course, but by and large, you know, most of the course is open, and you can just walk up and stand along the fence line and watch the race go by. There are some VIP hospitality areas where you got to purchase a ticket in order to get in. And then we'll also have a couple of fan zone areas. I mean, I mentioned that cobbled serpentine climb, which is in an area called Libby Hill Park, which will be an official fan zone, and frankly will be probably the best place to watch the road race. But, you know, you can find out about all this stuff at our website, richmond2015.com. And then, you know, obviously we're on Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. The website is certainly the best place to find information.
Well, I certainly appreciate you taking time of an evening to talk with me. And we will keep watching what's going on down there. Once again, Tim Miller, the operating officer, who's probably ready to pull all his hair out because he's only 169 days away from the World Championships in Richmond, Virginia. Thanks so much for talking with me this evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right, have a good night.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tim Miller talked to us from his office in Richmond, Virginia. He should be home already, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, well, he's not.
I think that's neat that you came up with a different name for the cobbles, with their crushed cobbles instead of.
I was sure that's what it said. Is that what it says on the website? Did you go to the website?
I didn't look at it while we were talking.
I can't look because, you know, I've got a different computer.
That would be just fine. But, yeah, I would imagine he is pulling his hair out. He does have quite a few things to do. And
well, you know, I've been we have been watching the whole development of the World Championships coming to Richmond. We talked to Tom Bowden over a year ago, and he was involved in his role as now, you know, sort of just as a spectator. But I'm very excited. I think this is a really important event for the U.S. when it comes to cycling, and I hope we show them a really, really good time.
I think events like these are great for the community also, because you don't have to build a stadium. You don't have to build a football dome thingy and spend millions of dollars just for that.
Well, as he said, it might have been better to do that.
Well, if they had a velodrome, it would be, you know, just one thing, that'd be fine, but it wouldn't cost anything like the big other sports that don't get as much coverage.
That's true. We have to skedaddle. It's the end of our show, and we hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week. I hope you get a chance to go for a ride. Remember, not too much matzah, not too much chocolate. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.